Okay, so I guess everybody's heard a little bit about the program versus the core. So this is kind of a talk somewhat out of sequence, and this is officially meant for the program, but it's really also a lecture, I think, for the course. But we're gonna launch right into this, and then I believe this afternoon at 1:00, Shelley and I will give you more organizational sort of stuff. So this is just sort of to provide a setting for, you know, in a, in quotes, "intellectual setting" for the kinds of things you want to be thinking about. So if you go to the, you know, the big evolution meetings, the Society for the Study of Evolution meetings, for example, you know, almost everything is about this kind of stuff. It's about stuff that happens outside of organisms and how that leads to various adaptations, you know, finding mates, getting resources, worrying about predators and pathogens, competitors, and so on. It's almost always on multicellular organisms, but you know, this is great stuff to know. We know a lot. We've learned a lot about natural selection, of course, over the years. We all believe natural selection is a powerful force, but it really doesn't get down to the nuts and bolts of evolution, you know, how adaptations are built from the intracellular level up. And of course, a focus on multicellular organisms also ignores, you know, about 95-98% of all biological diversity on the planet. So, Rob pointed this paper out. It was published, I guess, at the beginning of this year. I should just want to give some historical notes. Several years ago, a group of us had a meeting at Airlie in Virginia. National Science Foundation felt that it might be time to start integrating cell biology with evolutionary biology. So they actually initiated this, and we had this big meeting. A number of people in the room were at that meeting. A white paper came out of the meeting, and a group of us were invited to NSF to, you know, do a sort of a dog and pony show, and maybe there'd be a funding program, and so on. That didn't quite work out, but we hope there'll still be a funding program particularly focused on this area in the future. And then a number of our ideas were summarized in this paper in PNAS last year. I think essentially everybody but Aaron will be a member of this community in the next few months, and a couple people are already here. So, as I said, there are these two fields, evolutionary biology and cell biology. There hasn't been a whole lot of crosstalk between these two, so the idea is to sort of put these together. So this is the whole idea of the KITP program. There was a program something like this. Mukund was involved in this about 5 years ago, and I was invited as sort of what's the word?
Mentor.
Well, I wouldn't say mentor. I think that's being a bit too positive. But I was the token evolutionary biologist almost. There were, you know, it's hard to pull in evolutionary biologists with interest in this, but there are many cell biologists, of course, with interest in cell biology. So I'll just sort of provide a setting first, and then I'm going to give you some of my basic ideas on where things might be going, and that'll touch upon a number of the research aspects of various people in the audience. So, we start with the assumption that the origins of all aspects of biodiversity ultimately must come from modifications that are made at the cellular level. But we have to recognize as well, consider this particular issue here, to what extent do the internal workings of cells constrain the evolution of external phenotypes? Do the details really matter? People in evolutionary quantitative genetics have been working for years on a model called the infinitesimal model, which assumes there's an infinite number of genetic loci, each with infinitesimally small effects contributing to things like sizes of organs and so on. So the molecular details in that context actually don't matter. But those are models, and we're trying to get into biology here. But we do have to worry about whether there are enough degrees of freedom, so many degrees of freedom that there's many ways to build the same thing in the cell. And one of the students brought this up in the context of genetic networks. I want to emphasize for people outside of the field of evolutionary biology isn't just comparative biology, and then you make up some nice story about how natural selection drove biodiversity. But in the context of evolutionary cell biology, we do need really good comparative biology. And this is also true in the area of protein science, and I hope there'll be a lot of protein science biochemistry contributing to our understanding today. But there's really no, you know, people in these areas don't sit down and say, okay, I'm going to look at these 10 organisms and look at the genetic variation, the genetic causes of phenotypic variation among them, let alone variation within species. But that's the kind of thing you need to know if you want to understand mechanisms of evolution And to a large extent, our focus is going to be on what goes on inside unicellular organisms. But I want to emphasize that we're not drawing the line at eukaryotes. This is as much about prokaryotes, whatever they are. And we'll hear probably a little bit more about this. This is getting a little specialized, but there's been some uncertainty about exactly where eukaryotes came from. Let me leave it at that. But we want to emphasize that we're focused on prokes and eukes here. There are emerging a number of different scaling laws in cell biology from many, many different angles. And these are simply correlations of one trait with another. And one of the things we would like to understand, and I'll give you some examples of these, are what are the scaling laws that are important to cell biological evolution across the tree of life, and how can we explain these nice statistical relations. So what are the actual mechanisms at the biophysical level, population genetic level, that might drive these? And one of the reasons I'm very attracted to this idea of building a cohesive area of evolutionary cell biology is this is really an area ripe for the confluence of three different disciplines that have a strong theoretical background. Of course, I put population genetics in the middle there. I think I might have phrase the quote that nothing in evolution makes sense except in the light of population genetics, something like that. But trying to understand evolution without population genetics is sort of like trying to understand biochemistry denying the existence of the hydrogen bond. So biophysics is going to turn out to play a very important role in this field, and that's why we have people like Rob involved in biochemistry as well. So all three of these fields have their own really large theoretical basis, and in many cases, many of the mathematical techniques used in the different areas are very, very similar, and we can learn from each other in this sense. There's a lot of tricks that have been developed by physicists that those of us in Pop Gen don't really know a whole lot about.
So talking about this as an emerging approach or an emerging field, have people in the sort of traditional evolution or traditional cell biology met with skepticism? I haven't seen anything like that, but I'm curious.
Well, I guess there must be some historical skepticism or disinterest, I suppose. As I said, if you go to the big evolution meetings, there's not a whole lot that's really being focused on microbial organisms. But I wouldn't say there's been any, I haven't encountered any real intellectual skepticism here. Cell biologist, historically, you have a cell biology lab and you work on yeast for the rest of your life, and you don't go very far beyond the bounds of yeast. And of course, there's two different kinds of yeast that people focus on as well.
Or maybe what's happening is there's cell biologists who think about things in certain kinds of ways. There's evolutionary biologists, and just people don't talk to each other, right? I think that's from my point of view.
I think historically the communities have just been separate. And it is interesting. I mean, there's been this real emphasis on evolutionary developmental biology recently. But somehow we've just jumped over the cell in trying to understand evolutionary mechanisms. And we have a genome, a pretty sophisticated area of evolutionary genomics, molecular evolution, now EvoDevo, and we've sort of jumped over the cell. And I think that's where a lot of the action occurs, and this is what we're trying to put together here. And thank you for the question. I want to emphasize that talks here at KIT, and I thought I was supposed to be the sacrificial lamb here. That those of you from biology will know that it's usually regarded as being extremely employed to interrupt a speaker during their talk. I think it would be bad news if you gave a talk here and no one interrupted. And usually there's many, many dozens of interruptions. So Rob is supposed to reduce me to a pulp by the end of this talk. And if Boris were here, it would be all over already, I suppose. He's probably back there preparing. So, and then finally, I want to raise this issue here, is, we all believe that natural selection is one of the most powerful forces in the biological world, but natural selection is not all-powerful. What selection can and can't do in different lineages is really dictated by what I call the population genetic environment that I'll talk about in a second. And you still have this open question of how much of cellular evolution is driven purely by non-adaptive processes for reasons I'll get into in a few minutes. So the population genetic...
I have a question. So I always thought of evolution as these sort of like long-term, slow changes kind of thing. But there are these discrete events that can shape the course of evolution for a long time, right? Either population bottleneck or
yeah.
So is there some kind of theory that helps us understand and in some unified way discrete events and how they can affect future trajectories of evolution?
Well, I guess I'm giving a talk on population genetics on Wednesday, and I'll talk about population genetic mechanisms. But, you know, discrete singular events, you know, it's hard to, like the origin of the mitochondrion. I mean, it happened once. Stuff, you know, I'll actually return to this in a second. But it's difficult to make predictions, you know, about a singular event like that. But as we encounter more and more population genetics, you'll see we can at least make predictions about what is and isn't possible evolutionarily. So the population genetic environment dictates what natural selection can really accomplish. A mutation, of course, it has three dimensions. Mutation, of course, is the source of all variation upon which natural selection operates. The mutation rate varies by about 3 to 4 orders of magnitude across organisms. I'll show you some data like this. So the input of variation varies tremendously among lineages. Recombination assorts variation within and among chromosomes. This also varies dramatically across organisms. And one of the problems here is that there's basically one crossover per chromosome arm. So if you evolve a bigger genome size, actually the recombination rate per physical distance goes down. Random genetic drift, we'll be hearing hopefully a lot about over the next 3 months. Random genetic drift is the noise in the evolutionary process. It's dictated by finite numbers of individuals and populations, sampling finite numbers of gametes from generation to generation. But it's also dictated by the fact that our genes are tied together on chromosomes, because what that will do is make you a victim of all your nearby neighbors. If a mutation arises over here, and you might be slightly deleterious, if a beneficial one arises over here, it will drag you along to fixation with it. And, you know, low recombination rates create problems if you need two adaptations, two gene changes, different places in the genome. High rates of recombination will prevent those from being maintained in the same gamete and pushed. So recombination really dictates what's possible and not possible. So in terms of non-adaptive evolution, I've spent a lot of time. Rob, can you pull the thing out of your bag? I spent about 10 years or so of the book, Eaten by the Black Devil, or what was it? Okay, so I spent about a decade working on genome evolution. This is a very tasty book. I wrote this book about 6 or 7 years ago, I guess, trying to outline what I think are the mechanisms that explain the tremendous diversification of genome architecture and gene structural variation across the tree of life. And so this is what remains of this book in Rob's hands, anyhow. Yeah, I'm not going to go into genome evolution very deeply here, but I do want to make a point, is that we know that genomes range from being almost 100% coding DNA in phage and bacteria and so on, and there's a smooth transition until you get into big multicellular organisms that you see this leveling off of the amount of coding DNA in the genome. So this is just scaling coding DNA versus genome size, and these are isoclines. So if you're on that line, it means 100% of your genome's coding DNA. And you can see things eventually level off at a genome size starting around 10 megabases. That's that's sort of on the niche side. And what's happening here is that genomes grow. They're not growing because of an increase in the amount of coding DNA. You can see this quantum leap in the contribution for intergenic and intronic DNA. Almost all prokaryotes have genome structures that look like this, very simple streamlined genes, no introns subdividing the coding exons, very little intergenic DNA, and then you get this merge into this sort of gene structural organization in big multicellular organisms. I want to emphasize here, there's nothing special about bacteria. You can see this complete continuity scaling among the structure of genomes and the structure of genes between bacteria and eukaryotes. You don't have a sort of a sudden quantum break on the behavior of these scaling features between eukes and prokes. So the issue here is that eukaryotic genes have become much more complex than prokaryotic genes. introns have been added. In the case of the human genome, the average intron, I think, is about 4,000 bases. There's about 7 of these per protein coding gene. And there are these are intervening tiny islands of exonic DNA. The average exon in the human genome is about 125 bases. So the coding DNA are tiny islands in this gigantic sea of intergenic DNA and intronic DNA. And one issue here is that every kind of embellishment that gets added to a gene increases the ways you can break that gene. So this is dangerous stuff. To have any kind of addition of DNA to a gene increases the mutability of a gene. So if you want to add an intron, for example, we figured out that it's equivalent to adding about 30 nucleotides to the gene that can't be touched, because they have to be maintained as the proper signature for the spliceosome to figure out where to cut you out in the pre-messenger RNA. We have these big things on the front and the hind end of our genes, 5' UTRs. This is a dangerous thing to have on the front of your gene, because if you pick up a mutation to a premature translation initiation codon, then you will be 2/3 of the time out of frame, and the other 1/3 of the time you'll be putting something on the front end of your gene that shouldn't be there. So the point here is that all kinds of exogenous DNA is dangerous stuff. You have even intergenic DNA that you could say is completely non-functional. Of course, couldn't pick up a non-functionalizing mutation, but what it can do is pick up a functionalizing mutation that turns a neighboring gene on in the wrong time during cell development or organismal development. So all DNA is dangerous, and yet this has happened, and the argument that we've made is that this is allowed to go forward in the eukaryotic genome because of what we call small effective population sizes relative to bacteria and a high power of random genetic drift. These are weakly disadvantageous changes to genes. They're strongly enough disadvantageous that they can't be accumulated in prokaryotes, which we'll see have very large effective sizes, but they could go to fixation here. This eventually changes the whole genomic real estate going on in organisms, and then later on, natural selection can figure out something perhaps creative to do, like tissue-specific alternative splicing with introns and so on. But introns didn't evolve for reasons of tissue-specific alternative splicing. They evolved in a unicellular ancestor.
Joel? So how do you integrate your ideas about population genetics and neutral evolution with constructive neutral evolution, which is a same sort of thing but slightly different? So how do you bring those two
together? I meant to actually point this out. So I'm not the only one to be raising this idea about possible neutral evolution in at the cellular level. So the Canadian community has been fairly big on this. Ford, Doolittle is, and Julius Lukes, who'll be here later, I think, have been involved in some of these ideas. So without getting into too many details, the idea there is that you could have some kind of adventitious sort of interaction. Suppose two proteins fuse together or have a binding interface. It's not bad for you, but it's not necessarily good for you either. But you have nothing gained, nothing lost. But what can happen then is that interface over time, you've keeping the amino acid residues that would normally be exposed hidden. So you can then pick up additional mutations, say, to hydrophobic residues. They'll be hidden, and that will only, in the long run, you know, strengthen the interface. And so it makes permissive mutations that were no longer able to be there. And these guys have, you know, sort of run with this a bit and argued this, you know, you could really let your imagination go. This might, you know, be a way to think about how the ribosome might have evolved with, you know, additions of different proteins to make this very complex machine, when the heart of the ribosome is really the RNA. So, you know, hopefully I haven't misrepresented these guys' views, but some of you might want to look at this paper. I forget who, I think it was Julius Lukes who was the first author on at least one of these.
It was actually a paper from 1999 with Arlen Stoltzfus.
Yeah, that's the first paper.
First,
and Arlen was Ford's. Yeah, he's no longer involved in this apparently, but Arlen first brought this idea up, I think, when he was
a
student.
Recent paper.
Yeah.
2-3 years ago, I think.
Yeah. So this idea of possible neutral evolution has been, with respect to cellular features, has at least been entertained independently.
But have you tried to bring, so they don't bring population genetics
into this at all, but I think that
would be a really powerful way of bringing the two ideas together, right? A potentially disadvantageous mutation gets hidden by a protein-protein interaction, but they're all fairly rare events, but bringing in population genetics.
Yeah, so I'll use one example to just, I don't want to go through the details of population genetics today, I'm just trying to provide a setting, but I'll try and provide a very crude, you know, almost pictorial sort of approach to it for us.
Mike, what's in the next slide?
I've heard this is another one of Boris's great comments, so you can interpret that however you want. So there's the next slide. It looks like the one I showed a few minutes ago, but the words have changed. And so what I want to emphasize here is it's not just the population genetic environment that dictates what goes on at the mechanistic level of evolution. It's the cellular environment also dictates what's going on. And I've just picked three sort of dimensions here. There's historical contingency. So you could view this as Darwin's descent with modification. Selection operates, and mutation creates changes in phenotypes based on what's currently existing in the population. You know, when I started, I guess I'm one of the older people in the room now. In the early days of my career, it was said that biologists had physics envy because the physicists had all the money. And now, of course, the biologists have all the money, and perhaps there's some element of physics biology envy. But I think one thing we have to admit that, you know, when it comes down to constraints, you know, physicists win here. There are certain biophysical constraints, we think, on cells that you just can't, you know, break the biophysics barrier. But that one question I'll be returning to is how often do we actually get close to the biophysical limitations of organisms when natural selection is operating? There's this issue of molecular stochasticity. So this is, I've talked about finite numbers of individuals in populations. There's also finite numbers of molecules inside cells, and I'll show you a nice scaling feature in a few minutes. In some cases, such as messenger RNAs, these are often only represented by a handful. Sometimes the average number for one gene might be two or three. So that means many cells frequently have no mRNA for that particular protein. It will come on later on, but this means there's a lot of stochasticity within populations of genetically uniform cells, and this could be a source of phenotypic variation among cells that have otherwise identical genomes. So I'm going to go through three vignettes, and we'll see how far I get with this. These are just my own personal views. These are things that my lab has been working on, but I think are all relevant to the kinds of things we're going to be talking about in this program over the next few weeks. And I've tried to fit them into sort of different areas, so maybe there'll be something for everyone in this room. So I'm going to talk a little bit about scaling features of cells and some things that we've recently gotten into. There's this issue of the how good is natural selection? What is the level to which we approach molecular perfection? I'll talk about this with respect to replication fidelity and work we've done across a wide variety of organisms and make the argument that the differences in mutation rates are largely driven by random genetic drift. And then I'll discuss some issues in the evolution of higher order structure of proteins, the number of subunits in different proteins. And there are, I think, a lot of really unsolved problems that I'm hopeful a number of us can spend a good amount of time discussing, because this is at the heart of biology, and there's been very little thought put into this. So there's this paper published a couple of years ago by Nick Lane and Bill Martin. These are two kind of, some of you know these guys, they're fairly interesting personalities. They published this paper in Nature in 2010 called The Energetics of Genome Complexity. Both of these guys are inordinately fond of mitochondria. And so in this paper, they made the argument that there would be no eukaryotes whatsoever, or no cells with the complexity of a eukaryotic cell, or with the number of genes as eukaryotes had, without the mitochondrion. And they made the argument that the mitochondrion provided us with the energy to run cells. It provided us with the energy to build more genes. And so they have this sort of argument about the energetic currency of a cell and the individual gene cost.
Who are the others?
Nick Lane and Bill Martin. So Nick Lane has written, I think he's heading to be the next Richard Dawkins, but from a more biochemistry point of view. He's written a lot, he's a very good writer, he's written a lot of popular books. Let me leave it in, sort of trying to bring biochemistry into evolution. Bill Martin has spent most of his life focused on deep evolutionary phylogenetic issues, including the mitochondria. So to me, when this is an intriguing paper. I probably read the paper 10 times, and I still don't understand the paper, and I've even asked Bill several times. I'm not sure Bill understands the paper, but I believe Nick Lane might. So I don't, in general, agree with a lot of the ideas in this paper, but I do want to emphasize that, you know, it's somewhat of an inspiring paper. At least it got us thinking in an area that we weren't thinking about before. So one of the things I was immediately struck by is it's unclear why one would even worry about the energetic cost of running a gene. Why is that the appropriate currency? For example, we all know, or many of us know, that genes can be selectively promoted in populations that have nothing to do with energetics whatsoever. Weight acquisition, you know, avoiding pathogens. I mean, you could say it has something to do with energetics to the extent it keeps you alive and passing your genes on to the next generation. But it was a little bit unclear to me why we would worry about this energetic cost. So the basic idea, just to back up, is, you know, we started out with things like E. coli here with, you know, one or two nucleoids in here, and then the mitochondria evolved here, and that's providing increased surface area for ATP synthase, the big driver of ATP production in cells. So it's sort of a way of increasing your surface to volume ratio, if you like, for producing energy. And so that was the basic idea there.
I don't understand. What is your objection to this? Increasing the number of genes, why is that not a constraint?
Why is it?
Why don't you think it is appropriate energetic constraint?
Well, as we'll see, I'll get into this with some data. But it's not clear that you need more energy to add genes to your genome or to be a more complex cell. For example, there are eukaryotes that have lower number of genes than bacteria and still have complex cells and so on. So that's the point here. I'm going to sort of abandon, I don't mean to, as I tried to say, you know, it's an interesting paper to think about, but I'm going to show you some data that this is actually leading. Hold that place, but because I may be answering your question in a few minutes.
Excuse me. Can you explain what's the main argument about why the complex eukaryote cell cannot exist without the mitochondria? So why the energetics should be provided?
Okay, so you're asking me to be Bill Martin and Nick Lane, but
right.
I mean, basically it's illustrated here, and you can take home what you want. So this is sort of the energy production per gram of cells, and it looks like E. coli is doing. These are rather strange organisms to pick. Thiomargarita is a gigantic bacterial cell, I think, if I recall correctly. And euglena, almost nobody works on euglena. I'm not sure why that was picked. But the idea is per gram of cells, you've got more energy being produced in E. coli per gram of cells. But then if you think about the power per gene, there's more genes in euglena. Actually, I don't know that we know the number of genes in euglena, but that's another issue. But the point is that these numbers go up, is the argument. If you just take the power, the energy budget of the cell, and divide it by the number of genes, that's how you're getting this. So it's just a ratio of the energy budget of the cell, I think, to the number of genes in the cell. And so, as I said, I'm not defending this argument. It got us into an interesting area, and as you'll see, the data don't seem to even support this idea at all. We have real data on it. But so one of the things that got us into was just how much does it cost to make a cell, and to make an entire cell in terms of ATP hydrolyses. And I think, a long-term goal for evolutionary cell biology would be how much does it cost to make all the features inside a cell? How much of a cell's energy budget is apportioned to various cellular features, because that's going to be a baseline cost you have to pay just for building this thing. And you better get more out of it than what it costs to build it if it's going to be promoted by natural selection. So that's the idea here. And we're going to think about one particular cost, the cost of actually running and maintaining a gene. And so this is one of the things that got us into this. And then we need a meaningful cost measurement. Because I don't think just the number of ATPs that it takes to run a gene, maintain a gene, is the appropriate cost, because you need a denominator here. What you need to ask is, how does this cost compare to the total energy budget of the cell? So, for example, a dollar today is worth a heck of a lot more than a dollar was worth, you know, 100 or 200 years ago. And so, you know, the dollar is still the absolute value, but if you lost a dollar bill out on the street today, you wouldn't worry so much as, well, if you're a grad student, you might, but a couple hundred years ago, that would be, you know, your whole lifetime saving, I suppose. So we need the appropriate currency. So we've been working some of these ideas out. They're still at a fairly early stage.
So you're saying that ATP, one ATP can be used to do more today just because it's more efficient?
Yeah, so we're using ATP as the currency.
But the idea of inflation is very interesting. Inflation of what one ATP gives you.
Yeah, I'll hold that just for a second. And so from the standpoint of a gene, there's sort of three levels of cost of a gene. There's a cost at the level of chromosome. You have to replicate both strands of your DNA, and you have to do it twice if you're a diploid organism. There's an additional cost if you're a eukaryote, because you have to build nucleosomes, and that turns out to be a pretty big expense relative to DNA. There's a whole lot of things I'm glossing over, because I'm just trying to get the big picture. There's lots of other costs at the chromosome level. You know, opening up the origin of replication, building small primers, annealing the Okazaki fragments, blah, blah, blah. Transcription, there's the cost of, there's a baseline cost of producing, the biosynthetic cost of producing nucleotides. Transcription, there's the basic biosynthetic cost of producing ribonucleotides to replace the steady state number of transcripts. Then you have to account for the fact that transcripts decay really rapidly in cells, so cells are replacing their transcripts many times over the life of the cell. Then there's a cost at the level of protein. What is the biosynthetic cost of all the amino acids involved in protein production and so on? There's recycling of proteins. Of course, you can recycle your proteins and the amino acids involved, but there's actually a cost to protein degradation. All these things have to be added together, but the sum of these would be the total cost of running a gene. That's the basic idea here. And so these can be measured in absolute numbers. We know enough about biochemistry and cell biology to within, you know, the first, second decimal place of coming up with numbers on these. And we feel that these costs have to then be weighed against the total energy budget of the cell. So this is how I'm trying to address your question here. So the cost, so we're trying to come up with an evolutionary meaningful measure of cost. And so we think about the cost of any particular cellular attribute. It would be weighed against, the denominator would be the total energy budget of the cell. Okay, so you could think about this if, you know, running this gene was 10% of your energy budget, that would be like a selection coefficient of 0.1. If there's no advantage of the gene on top of the energetic cost, that would, if the gene was producing nothing that was advantageous for you, that gene would be removed from the population quite quickly because of the energetic cost. But what if it's down around 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 6, which we'll see in a second is often actually the case.
So out of the three processes, is protein synthesis essentially the most costly?
Yeah, you'll see some numbers, but yeah, exactly. In general, about to order magnitude, this is what we do, okay, so to start things out. About 90% of the cost of the gene is at the level of the protein level. About 9% is at the transcription level. And about 1% is at the level of replication. I mean, you only have to pay this cost once per cell cycle. But here, because you're recycling all your proteins, the cost actually goes up down here the longer it takes for the cell to divide, because you're constantly recycling your proteins and trying to hold on. So. This is where most of the cost comes in.
What are your thoughts about what the cost to keep it running? And I mean by that the post-translational modifications. And then, for example, if you're something like tubulin or actin, then you're going to do hydrolysis.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious if you've thought
about we've thought about all of those things. The supplemental material for this paper is about five times the size of the manuscript itself. Those are costs, but it turns out they're small compared to the biosynthetic costs. So they would be out in like the second, they're real costs, but they're out in the second decimal place.
So is is the average energy cost per gene in some sense a reasonable measure? Because, you know, if you look at the genes that are being expressed, it's a huge variance, and the distribution of expression as function of, well, expression versus gene number kind of thing, right? The distribution could be completely, like, skewed, and you could have a few genes that express a lot. So I don't know if the mean is the right measure, right?
Well, at a population of individuals with the same genotype, I think the mean is appropriate. But you'll see we're going to focus on the noise in the process as well. But I think you do raise a good question. I mean, we would like a fundamental currency, some fundamental measure that we could use across the tree of life. And everybody does use ATP, right? The energy from hydrolysis of ATP. That's why we've focused on ATP. You could say, and I'm going to show you some numbers, you could say maybe it should all be in units of carbon atoms or nitrogen or molybdenum or something. You know, we're going to do everything today in terms of ATP, but this is something perhaps worth exploring.
Does number one account for recycled histones?
Yes. Yeah. Anybody got any other worries? We think we've covered almost everything.
I have a worry that I think this is a cool analysis, but like if I was to think in the extreme limit of a virus, I would say that packing is a huge limit on having another gene, right? There's just so much room in that.
Yeah.
And I wonder to what extent maybe even in bacteria, that could be an issue, that you add a gene, you have that much more space taken up in the cell by the nucleoid. Certainly cells have, as they have more DNA, they are larger in the prokaryotic.
Yeah, so I agree with all that. What we'll see in bacteria in a few minutes with the data is just the cost of this is so high that even having one or two additional nucleotides in your genome could be selected against. So we could add on the cost that you're talking about, but we'll see. You're already at such a high cost relative to the cell's total energy budget and the power of drift that you would only push you further to the threshold.
So I was just wondering if you also consider whether the total energy budget and also the cost of the gene could be changed according to different environments.
Yeah, so let me return to that in a second, because the answer is yes and no, as we'll see in a second. We're going to see is there's a baseline cost for parts replacement of a cell, just building the parts that you have to replace. And then there's and you can think of that as a one-time cost for the cell. But then there's a maintenance cost. And that's something you're paying every hour after hour after hour. So if you're resource limited, you're still paying those maintenance costs. And the total energy budget of the cell then will go up with the lifespan of the cell.
One concern I'd have about energy budget, and I think kind of relates to some of the other concerns, is that it's in some ways it's sort of an indirect constraint, right? Because what really matters, I would say, is time. How quickly can you make all these things and reproduce? And energy is, you'd think it's
okay.
Some kind of
can you hold on to that for a second? And I'm going to show you something about time.
I see, okay.
Okay, but you know, if you're still perturbed, then
sure.
Let me know.
I have a last thing, which is, if I think about the brain, you know, I think that's our biggest, I know you're talking about single cells, but it's our biggest energy hog, as far as I understand. And I think the membrane potential, keeping that maintained, is really a very high budget item as well. So maybe one of the things we can talk about in the coming
That would be great.
Is
yeah.
that particular
How much
cost
does it cost?
In a bacterium.
Yeah.
So you're constantly pumping ions.
Right.
And that costs.
So I'm going to show you the total energy budget of a cell. And I'm going to tell you how much this stuff costs, but all the other stuff. I think this is an open question. I mean, how much does a cell pay for all its various cellular features?
Is it possible to actually do one of these calculations in one of the sessions, maybe?
In one of what?
In one of the sessions, is it possible that maybe we could...
Yeah, we could... I would be happy to go through... I'm trying to give you three sort of abstracts, and I think each one could go through in much more... I'm clearly glossing over a lot of the details, a lot of the technical details, just to try and get the big picture.
Are you having fun, though?
Am I having fun?
Yeah, like all the interruptions.
Yeah, and Boris will just tell me when to move to the next slide. So. No, so this is actually good, because this is what we want all the talks to be like. So, you know, those of you who are in the program and have never given a talk here before, I mean, I probably won't finish my talk, and that's generally what happens. And we can always extend things to an afternoon session or something, but, you know, if people don't ask questions, we're not going to be fulfilling our mission here. People are here from very different areas, biochemistry, biophysics, evolutionary biology, cell biology, and so on, and we're trying to provide an atmosphere for these kinds of interactions. So, and by the way, this work is being done with a postdoc in my lab who recently graduated from Caltech that some of you guys may know, Yogi Mirna. And so here's our evolutionary measure then. I'm saying that there's baseline cost. The total cost of running a cell breaks up into three components. You can think of the net advantage of the selective advantage of the gene as being a function of two things. So this would be, you think about this as sort of the phenotypic manifestation of a gene. It's making some protein that's good for you and who knows what. And that's the advantage you get out of having that gene and its products. But this is the cost you have of running that gene. That's how much energy it takes to run the gene. And the difference between these is the net selective advantage. And so if this cost here is higher than what you get out of the gene phenotypically, it's actually a deleterious gene. And you would expect natural selection to eventually eliminate it from the population. And I'll get into this more on Wednesday when I talk about mechanisms of evolution at the population genetic level. But we have this general rule here that 1 over NE, NE is the effective population size, and so 1 over NE is the power of random genetic drift. It's the amount of noise in the evolutionary process. And roughly speaking, if the absolute value of a selection coefficient is smaller than the power of drift, it's invisible to the eyes of natural selection. It just overwhelms, you know, selection's sort of a deterministic process, but if the noise process overwhelms the power of selection, then things will evolve in what we call an effectively neutral manner. So the attribute need not be neutral in an absolute sense, but this is why we have to worry about population genetics. As NE gets larger and larger and larger, selection can deal with mutations of smaller and smaller effects. So this is what in the realm of what we call effective neutrality. So how much does it cost to make a cell? And I'm going to gloss over all the details, and we could perhaps explore this in a broader talk later. But one can estimate the cost of building a cell in the following way. If you have some kind of microbial organism or any organism that can be grown on a defined medium, so if you can grow an organism in a chemistat, you can regulate the rate of input of your limiting nutrient just by the flow rate. The flow rate of the chemistat, by definition, is equal to the growth rate, the cell division rate of the cells in there. The chemistat will reach an equilibrium. If you measure the rate of input of your limiting nutrient, say glucose, and you measure the output of glucose, and you know how many cells are in the chemistat, and the flow rate, you can estimate the glucose consumption rate per unit time. And if you know the biochemistry of your organism, the metabolic biochemistry, you can then convert glucose consumption into ATP molecules. And you know, some of you guys learned about this in freshman biology, right? You know, how much energy you get from a glucose molecule through glycolysis and so on. And so there have been quite a few different studies done like this with a variety of organisms. And it took a lot of massaging of the data and collecting of data from really, some of these studies are now done in huge bioreactors because there's interest in growing different organisms for various reasons today. But you can estimate the number of ATP molecules in the lifetime of a cell. And I plotted this here for, I guess there's about 30 or so species here. This is plotted as a function of cell volume. So this seems to be a scaling law in cell biology that was revealed here. The number of ATP molecules to produce a cell, and it's broken into two quantities here. So one, the top line here, that's the amount of energy used for parts replacement. And the bottom line, and so that's a one-time investment in the cell. The bottom line is the amount of energy that you're using per hour just for maintenance. And you can get this from the studies of chemostats because you can grow the organism at different dilution rates and then plot the resource consumption versus the cell growth rate. And the slope ends up giving you an estimate of this. And the intercept, there'll be an intercept at hypothetically zero flow rate, so that's zero growth rate, and that's the maintenance rate you can estimate from this work.
So can I try out a different way on you of getting the same answer, which is in a cell volume of 1 micron cubed, you'll have about 3 million proteins,
okay,
each of which has 300 amino acids.
Yep.
Each amino acid takes 4 ATPs in order to put the next guy on the polypeptide chain. So once you know that, if you just believe a cell is a bunch of proteins, then you just change the volume, and that tells you how many more ATPs you've got. I guess I'm just curious, do you buy that?
Yeah, so
I roughly buy it.
So you also have, we think you have to account for the one-time parts, biosynthetic cost one time.
Right, I agree.
So Rob actually did some work on this a few years ago with Ron Milo, I think. Yeah. So I'm going to give you my answer. So do you even remember what you came up with?
Yeah, no, it's 10 to the 10th. Yeah,
okay.
I know it's 10. Well,
we're within a factor of 2.
Yeah.
So I'm going to sum up some important points, I think, from this. So the way you can think about this, for the total energy budget of a cell, it's this quantity here plus this times T, where T is the cell division time in hours, right? Because this is a cumulative cost. It just keeps going up and up and up. So if you're really, really resource limited, you just have to keep paying this for a very, very long period of time. And so actually the cost of a lifetime cost of a cell, of course, goes up with the total time to cell division. I'm going to show you some interesting scaling relationships. Basically, if the number of hours it takes to divide a cell is less than this quantity here, then over 50% of your lifetime expenditure is just on parts replacement. And we're going to see in a minute that cells can grow so fast that about 99% of investment is just parts replacement. And this is for cells growing at warp speed, and we have to acknowledge that in the wild, cells are probably very uncommonly growing
at speed. Can you say a little bit more about CM? Because that one I don't have a very good argument for.
So this is the, so let me summarize things here. So first of all, both of these scalings are, this is a log-log plot. And so these are what we would call allometric scalings with respect to cell volume. So they're almost isometric because the exponent there is very close to 1. So you change this guy by 1 log, that changes by 1 log. These slopes aren't significantly different from 1. So CM then is the amount of ATP you're using per unit time, just to stay in place.
Yeah, but I was just curious if you could tell me, like, when you guys estimated it, what are the key things that are involved? You know, there's protein degradation, there's mRNA degradation, there's transcription.
I'll tell you about the gene level cost in a second.
Okay.
But this is just the total, and this is part of the question. We're going to see the gene level cost is quite small.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so a lot, you're talking about channels and things. There's a lot of room for the total cost of a cell being due to a lot of other things than the gene. The gene cost of a gene, as we're going to see, is the least of your problems. So.
Hey, Mike.
Just ask you a clarification. So when you talk about cell growth, are you talking about cell increasing the cell volume? Is that what you mean?
Did I use the word growth? Yeah, that can be confusing. Cell division. Well, no, growth here is it's just parts replacement.
But then I don't understand cell division time, because then are you implying that it matters if you're a small cell and you double your volume and you become this big, or you become...
It'll be the next slide. Let's take a look at the next slide, and I'll show you those results.
When you say parts replacement, do you mean, so if the cells are growing, you need to make new parts? So what's the difference between parts replacement, which sounds to me like...
I can see why that might be misleading.
As opposed to...
But if you think of a cell...
Yeah.
In a species, and all the parts just sitting there in a static sense, if you could survey it, this is supposed to represent the amount it costs to build them. There's additional parts replacement due to recycling, and that's in here.
That's in the
That's in the maintenance, I think.
Okay.
That's the way I'm reading it.
So parts replacement really is...
Yeah, maybe I should use a different term than that. Biosynthesis, yeah.
Yeah, okay, so it's biosynthesis.
Right.
Because replacement to me means degrade it.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sorry for the... I guess that maybe isn't the best choice of words. That replacement of recycled proteins and mRNAs, that's all in here.
Okay. So just riffing off Rob's point a little bit, let's say that a calculation can give you what the slope and intercept of the line should be. It still seems interesting that there's such a large amount of scatter. Like there can be a decade of fluctuations. I'm wondering whether you think that's real, meaning biology, or is that experimental error? Has anyone actually tried to pin down?
That's an interesting perspective, because I found it interesting there was so little scatter. These are studies taken, you know, from a wide variety of labs over decades of work. Some are presumably much less reliable than others. So I'm not comfortable with the making much about the scatter. This, what really ought to be done is one lab ought to take a wide variety of organisms and use similar procedures to do this. But almost every one of these studies, there's a guy named Stouthammer who sort of founded this field decades ago, and their lab did do a number of these studies, but this was in very early days too. So
I'm guessing
there might be some real, you know, biological meaning to the scatter, but I'm not too comfortable with.
Yeah, I mean, even in one organism, the idea that the maintenance cost is always the same seems questionable. Because, for example, E. coli will look very different at slow growth rates. It's got a stationary phase, it expresses different genes. You can imagine that it's much more parsimonious with energy under those circumstances than when it's going.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. I think it's just that, you know, we don't know how much of this is just due to experimental error, laboratory differences versus real biology. But I think this is a very good question, because this is what we'd like to know. How much is it due to real organismal differences?
What's the red points?
Yeah, so let me go through some thank you, Boris, general implications. So this is what's amazing is this is isometric scaling with respect to cell volume. You double the cell volume, you double the cost of maintenance, and some word will come up for parts replacement. Now, what's really remarkable to me is this. So there's three colored points here. All the black ones, these are all prokaryotes. All the blue points are unicellular eukaryotes. So there is no dichotomous change between prokaryotes and eukaryotes. So there's nothing unique going on with respect to the mitochondrion being there, and it gives you some quantum leap. Now the red points here are, these are all cells taken from multicellular eukaryotes. I have not used these in the actual regression because I'm a bit worried about, you know, a cell from the liver of a mouse having sort of an out-of-body experience that's not really giving you the right kind of metabolic rate. But nonetheless, that's where they fall. And there's Marchantia, there's some plant cells up here as well. So even they, you know, some caveats, they're not too far from these results. That's Tetrahymena, a big ciliated protozoan. And so there's a scaling, continuous scaling across all organisms, both prokes and eukes, which I find not only quite amazing, but if it turns out to be true in general, this could be a very useful principle for evolutionary cell biology, because this is going to tell us the denominator, you know, what a cell's energy budget is. Okay, so Rob mentioned they did a back of the envelope. It was a pretty good size envelope, I guess, because you got a paper, a couple pages out of it, didn't you, in PNAS? But 10 to the 10th, I think, is what Rob said.
Yeah.
So if you just put a 1 in here, that's the normalization constant. That's 20. An E. coli cell is about 1 cubic micron. So we get about 2.6 times 10 to the 10th. So that's the number of ATP hydrolyses it takes to build an E. coli cell. So it's not very far from what Rob got with a completely different approach to the problem. And what I want to point out here, this is a big question that I hope we can think about while we're all here, is, I mean, these are just empirical relationships, right? These are just the data, and this is where the data fell. But at this point, I can give you no theoretical basis for why the slope is 1 or why the intercept is where it is, right? Why doesn't this line fall up here, which means cells are, you know, 10 or tenfold or so less efficient, or why doesn't this fall down here? Why can't organisms develop metabolisms that make them even more efficient than this? Why is this general scaling relationship hold? And so I think, you know, this is a good place for to bring in biochemistry, biophysics, and so on. But this seems to be a sort of a unifying principle.
I mean, isn't the slope of 1 kind of expected just from, if you could use a simple argument that it's just the cost of making all the stuff, and if you double the amount of stuff, then you double the energy you need to make it.
I mean, that's one way of thinking about it, yeah. But
that would be consistent with the slope.
I'm going to show you an example in a second. In fact, everything inside a cell, the amount doesn't scale linearly with cell volume.
So that's discordant with this.
You could just say every cell is basically had the same composition. Eukaryotic cells actually have quite a different composition than prokaryotic cells.
In terms of their density of...
There's more lipids, for example, in eukaryotic cells. But I'll show you some numbers, but just number of protein molecules and MRAs in a second.
I was just wondering if archaea are included in this diagram.
No, there's no archaea, so we should slash this and instead of prokaryote, put bacteria in there, eubacteria. So to my knowledge, we have nothing like this has ever been done in Archibacter. I wish I had these results before last week or so, because we could have probably set up some chemostats and done this kind of thing ourselves. It would have been great. So,
there's a question over here.
Anyhow.
In eukaryotic systems where a single body has different kinds of cells, do you think the maintenance budget may be same for all those cells performing different functions?
It'd probably be quite different. I think I think people think the brain has got a very high metabolic rate relative to some other tissues. So I would imagine it would differ among cells in a multicellular organism. That's why we've restricted this to unicells. Well, you can't do this kind of work anyhow. If you have an organism, you know, sort of chowing down on 50 different types of food, there's no way to reduce it to a common denominator of ATP, because you'd have to know what every food item was worth in terms of ATP. So we can't really do that with organisms that can't be grown on a defined medium. And I think if you took a brain cell out and put it in a chemostat, it might metabolically be behaving differently than in an actual brain. Let's see.
I guess I am confused about something, because I was going with Rob with his argument that, like, those are the costs of making protein, costs a certain amount of ATP for each residue. You figure out, you know, what's the density of protein. I didn't know if that varies significantly along this line, like the total amount of protein.
Yeah, I'll show you that in the next slide.
Okay.
Yep.
So let's go.
Boris? Next slide. Okay. We used to use slides. I guess nobody uses that word anymore. But okay, somebody raised the issue about cell division rate. I just want to point this out because I think this is another rough scaling law that we need to be able to explain. What I've done here is summarize an awful lot of data from a lot of studies in a whole wide variety of fields. This is the minimum known cell division time. And it's all converted to standardize it to 20 degrees centigrade as a function of cell volume. And just to go back to the previous slide, this is where your cell division rate would be to get to the point where half of your total cost of cell replacement was maintenance. And so when cells are growing at warp speed, they're far beyond that point. So the growth, the curve that I called growth, for a cell growing at warp speed, that's almost all your cost. But of course, in the real world, you know, cells can be growing a lot less than warp speed. There's now people talking about microbes that live in the sediments of oceans, with generation times of hundreds of thousands of years. So, you know, that's a long-term cost, just maintenance. But anyhow, here are the data, and there's the scaling. So you can see that the minimum cell division time scales much less than isometrically. It scales with about the 0.2 power of cell volume. So yes, as cells get bigger, they take longer to divide, but it's not linear by any means. And there's variation among lineages. So I've got everything from, well, you can see the different organisms. One of the things we work on, ciliates, they're relatively slow growers. What I want to emphasize is, though, a couple things. Bacterial growth rates, it's noisy, but it's significant. Larger, you can see all the...
How about giving people an intuitive test? Can I do it? I'm just curious. So people that don't know the answer to the question can answer, but those that know, you can't. So are fast-growing bacteria bigger or smaller than slow-growing bacteria? That's my question. Just knee-jerk reaction.
Your question is poorly posed.
Okay. Repose it.
You haven't told us how you're changing growth rate. It's very important.
No, I don't know about that.
What's your sample size?
It's very important.
So, okay, I'm going to make a media that where they divide in 60 minutes and they divide in 30 minutes. Which ones are bigger, the 60-minute guys or the 30-minute guys? That's my question. Who thinks 60-minute guys are bigger? Who thinks 30-minute guys
are bigger? We're worried it's a trick question because otherwise...
Well, I don't know. Like how... Yeah. I don't want to monopolize.
Okay, no,
it's fine, but I'm just.
Well, I hate to tell you, but it's staring you right in the face.
Yeah, I know.
Still, nobody's getting it.
I've done a lot of polls, and most people think that the slow cells, the ones that divide over 60 minutes, are bigger. That's what most people think is a knee jerk.
And that's true in eukaryotes.
Not in bacteria.
But apparently not in bacteria. But I mean, it's very noisy, admittedly, and there's not a wide range of cell sizes to do.
But interesting, if you change temperature to change growth rate, there's no scaling whatsoever. So cell size is completely flat as a function of temperature.
Yeah, so this is also a problem with Lane and Martin, because bigger, even in prokaryotes, bigger prokaryote cells, they're actually doing stuff faster. So they're not encountering an energetic problem. They're actually, for some reason, and this is just descriptive, they're actually doing things faster.
I mean, there is probably some kind of scaling advantage to complexity as well. Maybe you learn, if you have more complexity, you can do certain metabolic processes more efficiently.
Well, that's what I would argue is that the results say no, right? Because that's what this is all about. Okay, you're going from prokaryotes, multicellular eukaryotes with all the stuff eukes have inside their cells, and these are unicellular eukes and multicellular, and everybody's on the same line. Morphologically, these are much, I think most people would say that eukaryotic cells are morphologically more complex, not necessarily metabolically more complex.
So in fact, in the next slide, although this looks noisy, when people have done experiments in a single cell type and change media, the scatter is actually even less than this, and you get a very beautiful scaling of this type. The faster you grow, the bigger you are. But if you change growth rate with antibiotics, then it's the other way around. Okay, so I guess this addresses the question.
There's a reason for this, right? In bacteria, the faster you grow, you need more DNA because you can't copy your DNA as fast as you can divide. Okay. So you have to fire these rounds of replication early. You have more DNA, and at least the understanding is that's why you need the larger cell size. But that is an interesting difference between prokes and eukes, right?
Yeah,
in eukes, in different directions. You know, you replicate your DNA and then you divide. You don't get, very tightly correlated.
And interestingly, related to what you were just pointing out, larger bacteria actually have more genes in their genomes. So this is also inconsistent with the Lane and Martin argument, because larger bacteria have more genes, and they're growing faster, so they're not suffering from being bigger and having more genes. The genes aren't costing them anything.
In your groupings here with the prokaryotes, are they all maybe of the same genus, like Vibrio?
Oh, these are all over the bacterial tree. I will say a couple of these are mycoplasmas, and just to give you an idea of the diversity, I think those two are cyanobacteria, photosynthetic bacteria. So, sort of the data are all over. I apologize for the noise. Again, a lot of this is just, some of these were, a lot of this stuff came from oceanography labs and, phytoplankton biologists, but, there's traditional yeast is in there, but this comes from lots of different sources. So, but one point I wanted to make here is, Was there another question? A couple summary points is that, well, I've just made this one. And here's an open question, I think, for us to contemplate, is I just drew that line in here. That's this line here. And you can view that as sort of the lower limit to cell division time for organisms with different cell volumes, as a rough lower limit. It scales with cell volume, but, you know, very shallowly, with an exponent of, you know, somewhere on the order of 0.2. And so what is it about the biology of cells and all the internal metabolism and so on that dictates this growth rate speed limit, so to speak? And why does this speed limit scale in the way it does with cell volume? I don't have any idea what the answers are, but these seem to be fundamental questions that we need to figure out the answers if we want to have a generalized field of evolutionary cell biology with a theoretical basis.
So, can we just go back to thinking about cell division times? So are you saying that you have a cell, it's an interphase, it gets bigger, and when you talk about cell division, you mean it is mitosis and it gets its chromosome?
It's a time for one cell to be to become two cells. That's all it is. So ecologist, it'd be related to the intrinsic rate of growth. It's just the cell doubling time.
And there's something fundamentally different about one big cell and two little cells that have exactly the same volume. When you have a big cell, it gets to some size and divides into two.
Yeah. The cell is growing in terms of all its biomaterials, and then it divides, and there's two cells, 50% the size of the adult cell, and then they grow up. And the question is, how long does it take to go from baby to having your two kids?
Like, can you make a statement combining the two graphs, the one before, regarding the amount of ATP needed per volume of cell?
Yeah.
When you are, and relate that to cell division time. So when you divide, when you're large, you divide.
Well, what I'm saying is if you're growing at warp speed, almost everything is that growth curve, top line. You don't even, the maintenance thing is out in the second decimal place. But if you're growing at slower, if you're growing, you know, 100 times slower than the speed limit, roughly up here, then about half of your energy budget would just be sort of running in place, trying to keep all the equipment running and replacing your proteins. And cells, presumably, are often way up here. This is as good as it gets.
Like, just because I think it's super cool. So Clostridium actually is roughly the same size as E. coli and can be grown as fast as like 6-minute doubling.
Okay.
Which means that it'd be interesting to ask whether that's also an outlier in the sense of, like, have you somehow surpassed...
I think Clostridium's in here once or twice. I'll need to go look it up. Because I had to scale everything to one temperature, right?
Yeah.
And this is a limit on the data, too, because people grow their bugs at different temperatures. So.
But I think, for instance, like the DNA polymerase must set a fundamental time scale, but that could be broken in certain cases.
Yeah, it's...
So what occurs to me is that the difference between prokaryotes and eukaryotes, and you're saying there is none, right, in your data, right, that there's no discontinuity. But it seems to me that you're growing your eukaryotes or your eukaryotes over... in the chemostat, not in the way that eukaryotes normally grow, right? I mean, either they're swimming along and hunting things down,
yeah,
crawling along and hunting things down,
right,
or sitting there and suntanning. And that's basically it, right? They're not swimming in nutrient-rich medium. And
isn't that also true for, yeah, I think that's
true. Well, yeah, and so that's why I wanted to know. So this is...
No, it's a very good point. Let me try and address it this way. So a number of these studies, this is the reason I think ATP is useful. Mm-hmm. Because that's the ultimate currency. And you could be getting your energy from all kinds of different carbon sources, right? And very different than the ones being used in the chemostat.
Mm-hmm.
In some sense, this is what you're saying. But it all has to be eventually reduced to ATP. So a number of these studies in the previous slide, people have grown the bugs on different carbon sources. And the carbon consumption rate will change.
No, what I'm
but
wondering about
the same answer for ATP.
I guess I'm wondering about mode of nutrient acquisition.
Yeah.
and sort of dynamics of nutrient acquisition.
Well, most of the eukes are, I mean, tetrahymen is a stretch because tetrahymen is not living in a defined, you know, it's usually eating bacteria and stuff. But, you know, the two yeasts are up there and, you know, guanine glucose and things. I appreciate what you're saying. I mean, these are what...
And this relates back to what somebody was saying earlier about cellular complexity and the differences between bacterial and eukaryotic cells. Much of the cellular complexity I see is... as being, maybe that's because I work on membrane transport, but the point is that a lot of it is ways of getting the nutrients.
Oh yeah.
Right. Those are the differences in eukaryotic cells, right? Phagocytosis or photosynthesis or whatever.
I think maybe we're not that far apart. I'm not saying there's no difference between eukaryotes and prokaryotes. Biologically, there's lots of differences. But what I'm saying is when you reduce it to sort of the ATP requirements, there seems to be nothing special about eukaryotes. And I think it's fair to say, among a lot of evolutionary biologists even, there's this general feeling that eukaryotes are just somehow superior. And this is in the Lane and Martin thing, right? That's our underlying...
Aristotle's fault, we just know that.
Yeah, well, I showed you that scaling with genome complexity and gene architecture. You know, it's complete continuity of scaling across prokaryotes and eukaryotes, and now you see it for energetics. So there's clearly differences between, I'm not trying to put those kind of things under the rugs, but energetics, they seem to be behaving fairly similarly.
And so these differences, prokaryote, eukaryote, is like a difference in gait when you're talking about the power budget of movement, right? So by definition, almost, the power for movement at a certain speed is continuous. It's just, of course, you change the gait at this speed and the next speed and so on. As one mode of lifestyle becomes inefficient, and the next one becomes efficient. So I'm wondering, since you've shown now, you argue that there is no discontinuity of these numbers, if you put multicellular here as well, if that also scales on the right side of these curves.
I don't know how to do that, right? Because there's...
If we find one way to...
You would have to have a multicellular organism that you can grow on a defined medium.
There's no way to measure it. It's difficult, I agree.
But it's a good thought experiment, right?
Right.
So just to be provocative, this scaling is not that far from volume to surface area.
I know.
Right? I mean, if you say the total time, you have to replicate the volume, but the import rate, going like the surface area, and we give a third. So, I don't know.
Yeah, and there's a lot of scaling that's been found in various things in the field of ecology and life histories and things. And there's huge debates on is this 1/4 scaling? Because you could do some things with fractals and things. And the surface to volume stuff, you get into like 1/3 kind of things. And you know, you get these slopes that are like 0.29. It's like half, do we really believe, the geometric things that lead to 1/3 versus 1/4? But these are the kind of things that I think are maybe worth some thought into, why can't cells keep pushing down here? This is going to eventually get to something I call the drift barrier, but I'm not clear that I'm going to get there today. But one more aspect of scaling, I think what I should do today, and I'm just going to have to stop, so I will have only given you the first vignette, but at least we got people talking, which is maybe one of the main goals. So I'm going to just finish talking about the cost of a gene. To figure out the cost of a gene, remember the transcriptional and translational cost, you need to know how often you're recycling, how many proteins, how many mRNAs are represented at sort of steady state in the cell. And then you need to know the decay rates and how often they're replaced. Mm-hmm. Now, it turns out that there's about almost 10 species now where you have pretty good proteomic data. And we can say, what are the total number of proteins in a cell? And it scales according to volume. So there's also a nice scaling that needs to be explained. The slope is much less than 1 here. So this gets at your point of just the inner contents. It's not scaling isometrically. And here's the mRNAs. Unfortunately, we only have 4 bugs But you can see it scales. This is the total number of proteins summed over all genetic loci.
Were they careful about membrane proteins?
I think that's all in here, yeah. Well, this is just the total number of proteins, yeah. Now, these lower lines, these are the average, well, sorry, this is mRNAs and this is proteins. The lower lines, this is the average number of mRNAs or proteins per functioning gene in the organism. And you can see these are very low numbers down in the hundreds or dozens. These are, sorry, we're looking down here. That's a one there. So mRNAs are present in very small number of copies in a typical cell. These are usually log normally distributed. And so I've just drawn sort of idealized log normal distributions for organisms at different positions. The gray area means that the average cell has less than one mRNA in it. So that means it's Poisson. You know, a bunch of your cells don't even have an mRNA in them at any one point in time. And then the gene comes back on. And then the mRNA makes some protein, the mRNA goes away. And so now that we have these scalings of the number of proteins and the number of mRNAs per cell, we can figure out for a few species what the cost of a gene is for the entire population of genes. Because for four species, we know the transcription rate and the translation rate for the whole population of genes for four species. And that's all finely summarized here. So just to take you through this, E. coli. So what we're looking at is every gene in E. coli. We calculated the cost at the DNA level. That's here. It's a fairly narrow window. Most genes in E. coli are plus or minus a factor of two in terms of size, and that's what matters. That's the cost at transcriptional level. For bacteria, the cost of transcription is actually often less than replication. That's part of the reason is because transcripts are so rare, and you have to duplicate, you know, two of your DNA strands. And there's the so this is getting back to the point that was raised before, and there's the protein level cost, and there's the total. So this is all a scale of a log scale here. So these are log to the base 10s. I put these dashed lines in here. This is the power of random genetic drift. So this is roughly what we think 1 over the effective population size of E. coli is. If these costs are far to the right, that means selection can feel these costs and operate against. So for example, if you added a gene, it wasn't even transcribed or translated, it was just the DNA, the cost of replication would be easily detected by natural selection in E. coli, the energetic cost. These costs, this is the absolute cost, but what we're looking at up here is the cost on the scale of the fraction of the total energy budget. So for E. coli, I guess a typical gene costs you about 10 to the minus fifth of your total cellular energy budget. That's sort of what the gene cost. It summed over all levels. And then as you go over here, you can see these curves are moving to the right. We get way down here for Arabidopsis and C. elegans. And here's the effective population sizes of these guys. It's to the right of the peak. So not always, but frequently. And so what this means is that the cost of a gene in C. elegans, or many genes, can't even be, it's too weak to even be detected by natural selection. Okay, it's there, but in terms of the fraction of your total energy budget, it's very small compared to the power of random genetic drift. So this is why I think a gene, whole gene can be duplicated in a large eukaryotic genome and not even be transcribed, but just sit there for a very long period of time because it, in terms of the energetic cost of just the DNA, it can't really be detected.
Just an interesting thought to see what you think about something. You're basically that you could plot something like that for humans.
Yeah.
That you could try to see how this did change for a normal human.
Yeah.
For a tumor cell, for example.
Yeah.
You can think that this piece could like,
yeah, it would be interesting, right. Right. And you would like to do it in all the different tissues in humans. Because the cost will be different in different tissues because, you know, some genes are tissue-specific expressed. So there'd be no cost of transcription or... You can also use this for non-coding genes, right, that are never translated. They don't pay the cost of translation if they're just making functional RNAs.
Mike, why would you expect something to go far below the drift barrier?
Well, what's happening is that the cost is actually going up for these guys, but the power of drift is going way up. These lines are moving
up. No, I mean, in the sense of dynamically, then you would expect inefficiencies to crop up in replication so that you come back right to the drift barrier. Why would you
make it? Oh, I see. That's a good question. I mean, at the protein level, you can actually feel the total cost. Mm-hmm. So maybe this is actually close to the point you're trying to make. This is the total cost.
Okay.
You know, DNA level cost and chromosome level cost in eukaryotes is much higher than in bacteria because the genes are longer. You've got introns you have to invest in. You've got 5' UTRs. And then you've got nucleosomes. That turns out to be a very big cost.
I'm wondering how much it makes sense to compare one of our population size with these fractional changes in cost, though, you know, given the fact that apparently there's a rather complex relationship between the ATP budget and the time it takes to divide. And so whether it's clear that you really get a meaningful selection coefficient for evolution from changes in ATP amount that you can really directly compare to 1 over n.
Well, it's the energetic cost. It's all I'm trying to get is the energetic cost of the gene, just of running the gene.
Yeah, sure, but whether that's really a selection coefficient that we can think of the way we think of them in evolution, in population genetics.
Thinking of it as just the cost that you're paying relative to your total energy budget. And, yeah, I think you have a good point. I don't know how else to do it. So.
Well, yeah, this is not a very constructive criticism.
Well, no, I think it is, but...
But I mean, yeah, but ultimately you're taking it and saying that we want to compare that to 1 over n, and that tells us something about the fixation probability of a mutation that would change such a trait. And that's where we're assuming that it means what we think it means in terms of population genetics.
Well, I think if you had an energy-limited organism, you know, I would feel good about this as a baseline measure. Because I'm just looking at this, if you just want to insert a new gene, it's doing nothing for you. Could it just accumulate by neutral processes because the cost is so low energetically? Or could it just be eliminated? It turns out in E. coli, just a one or two nucleotide insertion is enough to be filled and could be eliminated. And this helps explain why bacteria have such streamlined genomes. Boris?
So is this a falsifiable statement? Is there a student project in it? So can one therefore add a gene to your favorite bacteria and see that it will be eliminated from the population on some accessible timescale? And conversely, can one add the chromosome, you know, get the polyploid eukaryotic cell and see that it is not eliminated?
Yeah, whether we can do it in the next 4 weeks is another question, but in principle, this could be done. You could take E. coli and just insert an inert piece of DNA that's not even expressed. You could modify it so it's expressed but doesn't get translated, and you could let it go all the way. And that would be something you could do in one of these chemostat environments.
But conversely, adding a chromosome to a eukaryotic cell, I doubt that...
That might muck a few other things up. Okay, so yeah, let's finish up some questions. I'm going to show you one more slide, and then I'm going to have to stop.
So I'm curious. You said adding one nucleotide should be felt by selection, but one of the organisms that I work with has a second chromosome that's just packed full of genes that look like they've come by horizontal gene transfer. Looks like a bunch of junk.
Yeah.
But it's been maintained in the chromosome. So how can I balance that with what you just said about...
Well, I would predict, the prediction would be either it's not junk. I mean, if it still has an open reading frame that's maintained,
okay,
then I'd be worried it's not
it
junk.
It's like junk, it's, you know, if you try to figure out what the genes are doing, it's really hard to figure out what they are, and they just seem to be sort of... It looks to me like this second chromosome is a place to accumulate genes that are acquired by horizontal gene transfer and keep them for a while and decide
yeah.
to do. But if one nucleotide can be felt, then how can you have a full, you know, sort of garage full of genes
well, part of I would say that's pretty uncommon in bacteria. I mean, one argument would be the bacteria we're working in is historically at a small affected population size. And there are bacteria that have picked up lots of mobile elements, for example. And often those are endosymbiotic bacteria that folks have argued have, are actually experiencing more than the ordinary power of random genetic drift. So that's.
I think some vibrio also have second chromosomes.
Right. We've actually been working on some of these mutation rate work and so on. But those chromosomes have a lot of important genes on them in the vibrios. Let's
see. But they also have a lot of other stuff.
Yeah, but not, I mean, relative to eukaryotes, I mean, most bacteria are incredibly streamlined. I mean, I appreciate what you're saying for sure, but
I've just been trying to figure
you know, compared to a human genome.
Myself, and yeah. When you said one nucleotide is enough to be felt, it
yeah.
Really makes me.
Well, that's the prediction. Yeah, and as Boris raised the possibility of doing experiments on this, I think it could be tested experimentally.
The total energy budget is the total amount of energy being used by the organism.
Yeah.
Right. So is that determined by the environment? So like how much glucose you're adding, or is it determined by the ability of the organism to convert glucose or whatever into ATP? So for example, can you tune the budget by tuning the environment?
Yeah, so one way to answer that, and there's a need for a lot more work on this, but I think the reason I like ATP
yeah.
as the final currency, these kinds of experiments to measure this have been done in a number of microbes with different carbon sources. So a different carbon source will go through a different metabolic pathway, right? And so the conversion of that carbon source, it's a different environment, and the conversion to ATP has to be different if it's going through a different metabolic pathway. And yet you will get a very similar answer in terms of ATPs. It's not the same answer in terms of carbon consumption.
Is it clear whether organisms are making just as much ATP as they can versus making the ATP that they need for their current biology?
I don't know. Yeah.
So like building off of Boris's suggestion, for example, if you added a gene to you know, E. coli or something like that, and then had one chemostat with a lot of nutrients and you know chemostats with varying degrees of nutrients, could you potentially see that it's lost faster in some environments?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, some ATP probably leaks out, for
yeah.
example. I mean, the ideal approach here would be if someone had a way to actually count ATP hydrolyses directly in the cell rather than this indirect way, because then this could apply to any, you could use this for anything, but I think it's a good question. I mean, the assumption here is that ATP is sort of a halfway decent currency for, you know, the ultimate energetic limitation.
But I guess also the assumption is that the cells are sort of like millionaires when it comes to ATP, that it is scarce most of the time,
uh-huh.
and that it's really budgeted carefully instead of being something where they can produce more or less as needed, or they're always flooded with ATP, in which case the selection pressure would be really different.
Well, I think you know, if you were always flooded with ATP, given that's running the show, then you know you would be growing it at warp speed, you know, most of the time. So.
Okay, so it's still limiting. That's the sort of limiting factor for.
Well, that's the supposition here, but I think you're raising a good question. Let me just finish with this final slide because there's going to be another seminar coming in here at 12:15. I've only finished 2/3, but as I said, this is what happens here, and we actually want it to happen. So we'll return to a couple other things later, but. What I've illustrated here now is the cost of a gene. This is the average gene in about 30 different organisms now. We just know the average gene structure and the average rate of transcription of a gene. It's scaled against cell volume, and I just want to illustrate you know, 2 points. One is there's a negative scaling. So when you think about the cost of a gene relative to your total energy budget, it actually declines as cells get larger and larger and larger. So this is, you know, completely inconsistent with the Lane and Martin thing that the cost of a gene is going up and up and up. It's not from the standpoint of the fraction of your total energy budget. So that's one thing to point out. And the other is just an interesting side observation here is, again, there's almost complete continuity of scaling here among bacteria and eukaryotes. The slope may change, but it's hard to know where these slopes change. If that's just a general scaling feature in biology, the or a difference between eukes and bacteria. The problem being that we have very few cells. You know, the range of cell sizes in which there's an overlap between eukaryotes and bacteria is not very large. So unfortunately, you can see it sort of falls in some of these cases right near the break. But in terms of the transcription cost, it's more or less a continuous thing. So again, I think the main point, this is another reason for emphasizing, we want to spend as much time thinking about prokaryotes as eukaryotes here, is, you know, there seem to be these fairly uniform scalings across all these organisms. So I'm just going to end now. I guess if nothing else, we at least started thinking about possible general scaling features in cell biology. And as I said, these are just observations. What we don't have is any kind of general evolutionary theory that explains, you know, why is this line, you know, way up here instead of way down there? And how far can selection, you would want to move down as far as possible. You'd want your gene to be, you know, effectively free in terms of the energy it costs. And on the other hand, why doesn't anybody wander way up here? So those are some of the things that we might think about. And maybe we can start, you know, we'll have to put our heads together. Maybe there is something we can do in the lab. Somebody around here must have some chemostats at UCSB. Maybe we can. We don't want to get too sidetracked, but it is something that we could think about. Okay, so I'm sorry I didn't get through, and maybe I can return to replication fidelity stuff. And I really want to talk about the protein stuff a lot, because we're going to have quite a few protein scientists here. So, but I'll just have to return to that some other time.
Okay, thanks.